Welcome to this deep dive into the foundation of practice. To set our bearings right at the start, I want to give you a clear overview of our topic, our sources, and, well, the specific mission for this session today.
Mm-hmm.
We're examining a really remarkable, deeply systematic presentation of the Bodhisattva path. And our primary source material here is a comprehensive series of 15 teaching sessions delivered back in 1996 by Geshe Dawa Gyaltsen at Buddha House in Adelaide.
Right, which was carefully preserved and translated by the Bodhi Archive, thankfully.
Exactly. So our mission today is to really guide you through the exact architecture of the Bodhisattva vows. Specifically, we're looking at the 18 root vows and the 46 secondary vows, as they're understood in the Gelug tradition of Tibetan Buddhism.
Yeah, and I have to say, it is a profound privilege to explore this material. I mean, Geshe Dawa Gyaltsen's presentation is just, it's an absolute masterclass in the practical daily mechanics of the Mahayana path.
It really is.
The tone we want to establish here, you know, for you listening, is one of steady, measured exploration. This is ancient, established Buddhist wisdom being respectfully transmitted, really, as a practical manual for transforming ordinary actions into the causes of full enlightenment.
Right. And to start that transformation, I think we have to look at how we frame the whole concept of a vow.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to throw out a premise here.
Go for it.
When most of us in the modern world hear the word vows, we almost immediately picture a cage. You know, we think of a heavy, restrictive list of strict do-nots.
Oh, absolutely. Rules designed to make life smaller.
Exactly. Tighter, less free. We associate vows with taking away our autonomy.
Yeah, and that is a very common, very Western, and, well, ultimately incorrect lens through which to view Buddhist vows.
How so?
Well, when you step into the vast, expansive framework of the Mahayana tradition, which, just to clarify, is the path centered on that altruistic intention to achieve full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings, you realize that vows aren't chains at all. They're scaffolding.
Scaffolding. I like that.
Yeah, they're this supreme, highly practical architecture that you actually need to build a mind capable of unimaginable compassion and insight. Because without that scaffolding, the sheer weight of our own habitual delusions, you know, our anger and greed, it just collapses the entire structure of our spiritual practice.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because these teachings by Geshe Dawa, they don't just emerge in a vacuum, right?
No, not at all.
They draw their authority directly from ancient foundational texts. Specifically, we're looking at the wisdom codified in Asanga's Bodhisattva Bhumi, the Bodhisattva Grounds, and the Akasagarbha Sutra.
Right.
But what I love is that Geshe Dawa doesn't just hand us a raw list of rules and say, read these, memorize them. He contextualizes them. He says, to understand the specific vows, we first have to look at the vessel that holds them.
The overarching framework, yeah. What is known as the three moralities.
Right. So let's talk about those.
So the three moral disciplines of a bodhisattva, Geshe Dawa explains that every single vow, every practice, every action a practitioner takes, it all fits into one of these three categories. First, you have the morality of abstaining from misbehavior. Second, the morality of integrating virtue. And third, the morality of benefiting other sentient beings. It's a very progressive, logical sequence.
I want to take those one by one very deliberately because the sequence seems so critical. That first one, abstaining from misbehavior, that's the bedrock.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, in previous discussions of ethics, I've often heard people use cliches like, you know, you cannot build a skyscraper on a swamp.
Right.
But looking at Geshe Dawa's teachings, I think a much better analogy is a surgical theater.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, like if your ultimate goal is to perform life-saving surgery on someone, which would represent the third morality, benefiting others, you first have to scrub in. You have to sterilize the room.
That's a brilliant way to put it.
Abstaining from misbehavior is scrubbing your own hands so you don't introduce a deadly infection into the patient.
Yeah, that is a highly accurate way to look at it because the infection in this context is our own mental affliction. It's our anger, our greed, our deep-seated ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't abstain from misbehavior, you're just bringing those afflictions directly into your interactions with others. So, for a fully ordained monk or nun, this baseline sterilization means upholding the Vinaya vows.
The monastic code.
Exactly. For novices, it's the novice vows. For lay practitioners, which, you know, includes many listening to this deep dive right now, it might be the five lay precepts, known as the Pratamoksha.
The vows of individual liberation.
Right. And even for someone without any formal vows at all, it means strictly abstaining from the 10 non-virtuous actions.
Like killing, stealing, sexual misconduct.
Yes. Lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle gossip, covetousness, harmful intent, and wrong view.
It seems like such an unglamorous starting point, though, but Geshe Dawa is uncompromising here.
Very uncompromising.
He literally states that without this base of simply stopping our harmful physical and verbal actions, any higher, more esoteric practices like complex tantric visualizations or, you know, profound meditations on emptiness, they will completely crumble.
They won't just crumble, they'll become dangerous.
Really? Dangerous.
Yeah, because you're building immense energetic power without the ethical container to hold it safely. Which leads us directly to the second morality. Integrating virtue.
Okay, scrubbing in is done. Now what?
Once you've stopped the bleeding, once you've stopped actively causing harm, you have to actively cultivate the good. This is about ripening your own mental continuum.
How does one actually do that?
You do this through the classical Buddhist triad. Listening to the teachings, contemplating them deeply to clear up any doubts, and then meditating on them to integrate them into your nervous system. You are doing the quiet internal work to ripen yourself.
And only after those two are established do we arrive at the third morality.
Right. Benefiting other sentient beings.
Which is where we step out and work to ripen the mental continuums of others. And Geshe Dawa breaks this down into 11 specific ways of helping, which we'll get to. But here is where I struggle practically and where I think there is a massive trap for modern practitioners.
Let's hear it.
It is incredibly tempting to want to bypass step one and two and just jump straight to step three.
Oh, of course.
Especially today, right? We all want to be the activist. We want to be the savior, the hero. It feels grand and noble to save all sentient beings, while the tedious, quiet work of just guarding our own virtue and stopping our own toxic behaviors, it feels so small.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that desire to skip ahead is actually a manifestation of ego, not compassion.
Wow, ego.
Yes, it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the Bodhisattva path. Geshe Dawa reminds us that these three moralities constitute the single unified path followed by all Buddhas of the three times. There is no shortcut. To benefit others effectively, to truly ripen their minds without your own savior complex or your own need for validation getting in the way, you must first ripen yourself.
Because otherwise you're just projecting.
Exactly. If your own mental continuum is just a storm of agitation, your attempts to, quote unquote, benefit others will often just project your own confusion onto them.
So with that framework firmly in place, abstain, integrate, benefit, we can begin to examine the exact commitments a practitioner makes to stay on this path.
The core of his presentation.
Right, the 18 root vows. And the word root is doing a lot of heavy lifting here, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, if you cut the root, the tree dies. Breaking one of these vows fundamentally severs the practitioner's connection to the Bodhisattva path.
That is immense gravity. So how are they categorized?
Well, they're categorized by their textual origins, which Geshe Dawa meticulously outlines. He groups four of these vows from Asanga's Bodhisattva grounds and 13 plus one overlap from the Akashagarbha Sutra.
Got it.
But what requires our closest attention here is the sheer psychological subtlety of these downfalls. We aren't just talking about gross physical crimes.
Right.
The Mahayana path is deeply, deeply concerned with the mind's hidden motivations.
Okay, let's examine vow number one, which is drawn from the Bodhisattva grounds. Praising oneself and belittling others, motivated by a desire for gain. Now, I need to pause here because at first glance, this just sounds like standard arrogance or bragging. But Geshe Dawa explains it's much more surgical than that.
It is.
It's specifically weaponizing your speech to elevate yourself and push someone else down, driven by an underlying attachment to wealth, respect, or reputation.
The underlying motivation is the entire mechanism of the downfall. Let's really look at the psychology here.
Please do.
You might praise your own qualities to inspire a deeply discouraged student to practice, right?
Sure.
That is motivated by compassion, and so it is not a downfall. But if the subtle mind is thinking, I want that grant funding, or I want to be seen as the most realized practitioner in this Dharma center.
Ah, I see.
And you actively step on another practitioner to secure that status, you have severed the root. You have fundamentally betrayed bodhicitta.
Because bodhicitta is the altruistic intention to achieve enlightenment purely for the sake of others. So you're contradicting the very foundation.
Exactly. How can you claim to be dedicating your entire existence to the welfare of all sentient beings when you're perfectly willing to commodify, crush, or diminish one of those very beings just to get a little more praise for yourself?
Right. It's hypocritical.
It's a complete contradiction. The vow is broken, not just by the words spoken, but by the utter failure of the altruistic intention.
That is incredibly sobering to think about in the context of our daily lives, especially in professional environments where self-promotion at the expense of competitors is often, you know, actually rewarded.
Well, completely. It's the norm.
And it gets even heavier when we look at the vows derived from the Akashagarbha Sutra. I want to look closely at vow number 9, holding wrong views.
Yes, a very profound one.
Geshe Dawa defines this as actively denying the law of karma, denying the existence of the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, or denying other established truths.
And Geshe Dawa issues his absolute starkest warnings around this specific vow. He emphasizes that holding wrong views is uniquely dangerous to the spiritual architecture.
Why is that one so uniquely dangerous?
Because it completely stops the accumulation of virtue at its source. Let's break down the mechanics of karma for a second. Karma isn't a cosmic punishment system, right? It's just the fundamental law of cause and effect applied to intentional action.
Right. Actions have consequences.
Exactly. So if you hold the wrong view, that actions do not have corresponding consequences. If you adopt a nihilistic stance that nothing really matters, there is no logical reason left in your mind to practice morality.
He also points out that wrong view doesn't just stop virtue. It spontaneously produces non-virtue.
Yes, because the internal mechanism of restraint is dismantled.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't believe that harming another being leaves an imprint on your own mental continuum that will ripen as suffering later, the only thing stopping you from harming them is external consequence.
Like getting caught by the police.
Right. And if you think you won't get caught, the wrong view actively gives permission to the mind to engage in cruelty or theft or deceit. It's a breeding ground for harmful actions because it's a complete inversion of reality.
Here's where it gets really interesting, especially for those listening who might be studying in modern or Western Dharma contexts where different traditions mix all the time.
Oh, yes. Vow 14.
Yes. Let's look at vow number 14, disparaging the Hinayana teachings. So the Hinayana, often translated as the foundational vehicle, encompasses the paths of the hearers or solitary realizers.
The practitioners aiming for their own individual liberation from samsara, the cycle of suffering.
Exactly. And Geshe Dawa gives a very pointed warning for Mahayana centers regarding this vow.
He addresses a very specific spiritual sickness here. Mahayana arrogance.
Right.
There's this terrible trap that creeps into communities studying the vast teachings of Bodhicitta and the profound philosophy of emptiness. A subtle elitism forms.
Oh, for sure.
Practitioners start thinking, well, we have the higher teachings. We're aiming for full Buddhahood for all beings. Therefore, those foundational teachings, the strict monastic discipline, the intense focus on personal liberation, they're quaint or lesser, or frankly, beneath us.
And Geshe Dawa makes it incredibly clear that disparaging other Buddhist vehicles, or indeed disparaging other religious traditions entirely, is a root downfall.
It cuts the root. And he explains exactly why a Mahayana practitioner must study and respect the foundational vehicles. It's not just about being polite or interfaith dialogue.
Right, there's an actual mechanical reason.
The logic is impenetrable. To lead all beings to full enlightenment, you must understand all paths. You cannot guide a student along a path you yourself have dismissed, mocked, or refused to learn.
That is the essence of a bodhisattva's vast, encompassing perspective. You're not collecting teachings to build an exclusive intellectual club, right?
No, you're gathering spiritual tools.
Tools to save diverse beings who have wildly diverse karmic dispositions and needs.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if you disrespect the tool, you fail the being who desperately needs that specific tool. You are literally cutting off an avenue of liberation out of sheer spiritual snobbery.
So breaking a root vow is a catastrophic failure. It requires a complete formal resetting of the vows. But Geshe Dawa brings up a point that I think resonates with anyone who has ever tried to maintain long-term discipline. It's rarely the massive catastrophic failures that ruin us. It's the daily subtle infractions that slowly, almost invisibly, erode a practitioner's focus and integrity over time.
That is a crucial insight. You know, a great building rarely collapses from a single earthquake. It usually falls because of decades of ignored water damage and unseen termite rot.
Right.
And the 46 secondary vows, they are the diagnostic tools we use to catch that subtle erosion before it compromises the root structure.
So how does he organize them?
Geshe Dawa organizes these secondary vows perfectly around the framework of the six perfections. Generosity, morality, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom.
Let's do a real diagnostic on the mind using some of these secondary vows. In the sessions focused on the perfection of morality, Geshe Dawa outlines several secondary faults. One that stands out immediately, and which I personally find deeply challenging, is ignoring the objects of compassion.
Oh, yes?
He specifically defines this as turning away from those who have broken their vows, or those who have deeply wicked, difficult, or abrasive natures.
It is incredibly challenging, because it cuts right against our biological instinct for comfort.
Completely.
It's very easy to feel compassion for the cute, the polite, the deeply grateful, or the innocent. But the Bodhisattva vow requires us to extend our practice toward the hostile, the arrogant, the ungrateful, and the deeply flawed.
Mm-hmm.
If we turn our backs on someone simply because their behavior is difficult or what we might label wicked, we are failing the perfection of morality.
We are essentially telling them, my compassion is conditional upon your good behavior, which, let's be honest, isn't true compassion at all. It's just a transaction.
Precisely. If a doctor only treats healthy patients because the sick ones are messy and complain too much, they aren't a doctor.
Right.
A bodhisattva is a physician of the mind. The more afflicted a being is by anger or cruelty,
yeah,
the sicker they are, and therefore the more they are the proper object to our compassion. Turning away from them is a secondary downfall.
Another massive trap under the perfection of morality involves what Geshe Dawa calls the five wrong livelihoods. He lists them as pretending, flattering, hinting, taking by force, and seeking rewards for small gifts.
Mm.
I want to spend some time here because, while this applies strongly to monastics relying on alms, the psychological mechanics apply to absolutely everyone in their daily lives.
Oh, they map perfectly on a modern life.
Right.
Let's dissect the psychology of each.
Sure.
Pretending is projecting qualities you do not possess, acting deeply realized or uniquely holy, specifically to gain offerings, respect, or status.
Like curating a fake spiritual persona online.
Exactly. And flattering is praising a patron, a boss, or a teacher, not out of a genuine recognition of their good qualities, but as a calculated manipulation to soften them up so they'll give you something.
Okay. Hinting is the one that I think catches so many of us in modern life. It's the passive-aggressive cousin of asking.
Oh, definitely.
Like, oh, my car's been making such a strange noise lately, I just don't know how I'll manage to afford the repairs. You know, you aren't asking directly for money, but you're manipulating the emotional environment to extract resources from someone else. Why is this considered a wrong livelihood?
Because it fundamentally corrupts the transparency of the mind. Bodhicitta requires radical honesty.
Mm-hmm.
Hinting operates in the shadows. It relies on inducing guilt or obligation in the other person, all while allowing you to maintain the plausible deniability of never having actually asked. It is a subtle form of theft through emotional manipulation.
That makes so much sense. It destroys the integrity of the relationship. And then they're seeking rewards for small gifts. This is giving someone a little something with the calculated expectation of receiving something much larger in return.
Right. It turns the sacred act of generosity into a marketplace transaction. It's investing. It's mm-hmm. not giving.
Exactly.
These five wrong livelihoods are subtle corruptions. They slowly poison the practitioner's motivation until everything they do is tainted by self-interest.
Moving on to the perfection of effort, Geshe Dawa talks about the fault of indulging in laziness. And he doesn't just mean lying in bed all day, does he?
No, not at all.
He highlights a very specific active form of laziness, the trap of getting attached to gossip about worldly affairs, spending hours discussing politics, analyzing the daily news cycle, arguing over mundane societal events.
It is a brilliant psychological observation. Because engaging in heated arguments about worldly affairs feels like action.
It does. You feel productive.
Right. It feels like you are engaged, informed, and doing something important. But from the strict perspective of the Bodhisattva path, if it takes you away from your actual practice of transforming your mind and instead disperses your mental energy into outward agitation and anger, it is a form of laziness.
Wow.
You are actively avoiding the hard, unglamorous internal work by distracting yourself with the loud external noise of the world.
It's spiritual procrastination disguised as civic duty.
Perfectly said.
And that dispersal of energy destroys our capacity for the next perfection. Concentration. Geshe Dawa outlines the faults of concentration in three phases. Preparation, main practice, and conclusion. During the main practice, he warns against failing to abandon the five obstructions. These are mental distraction and regret, sleep and mental dullness, harmful intent, desire for sense objects, and doubt.
And anyone who has spent even 10 minutes on a meditation cushion knows these five intimately.
Oh, painfully so.
You sit down with the intention to focus, and immediately your mind is paralyzed by regret over an awkward conversation you had 5 years ago.
Or a wave of heavy, inescapable sleepiness just crushes you.
Exactly. Or you start planning your dinner, gripped by desire for sense objects. These are the classic obstructions that must be actively countered. But what is truly profound in Geshe Dawa's teaching is his warning about the conclusion of the meditation practice.
Yes, this caught me completely off guard. He says it is a secondary downfall to become attached to the bliss and joy of the meditative experience itself.
It is the ultimate trap for an advanced meditator. You finally push through the dullness, you clear away the distraction, your mind settles perfectly, and you experience a state of profound peace, clarity, or physical bliss.
Right.
And what does the subtle ego do? It grasps at it. It says, this is amazing. I want to stay in this peaceful state forever. I never want to get off this cushion and deal with my noisy family, my stressful job, or the suffering of the world.
But isn't peace the goal? I have to imagine many listeners are thinking, wait, isn't finding peace the whole point of meditating?
For a practitioner seeking only their own liberation, yes. But for a bodhisattva, absolutely not. That attachment to meditative bliss directly contradicts the core mission. The bodhisattva does not meditate to escape the world. They meditate to build the mental strength required to return to the messy, suffering world and be of maximum benefit to others. If you hide in your meditative bliss, you are abandoning all sentient beings.
And to effectively return to that messy world, you need the perfection of patience. Geshe Dawa outlines what he calls the four principles of patience. When I first encountered these, I genuinely struggled with them. Let me list them for you. If abused, do not abuse back. If someone is angry with you, do not get angry back. If hit, do not hit back. If told one's faults, do not immediately retaliate by pointing out their faults.
This raises an important question, doesn't it? Because this teaching is not just countercultural. It is radically opposed to almost every instinct we have.
Completely.
Everything in our modern, hyper-individualistic society tells us to clap back. We're taught to defend our boundaries aggressively, to demand respect, and to ensure that if someone strikes us, verbally or physically, we strike back twice as hard to establish dominance. The societal expectation is immediate retaliation.
So how do we apply this practically? Are we supposed to just be doormats? I mean, if someone is berating me in a professional setting or acting aggressively, does the perfection of patience mean I just smile and take the abuse?
Not at all. And this is where we must understand the mechanism of patience deeply. Patience is not weakness. It is supreme mental control.
Okay, explain that.
Geshe Dawa is very nuanced here. He advises that when confronted with someone's anger or abuse, you maintain complete internal equilibrium. You stay calm outwardly, and you wait. You wait for the other person's mental continuum to calm down before engaging or trying to discuss the matter logically.
Because engaging with anger is useless.
It is worse than useless. It is destructive. Retaliating while someone is in the grip of anger is like throwing gasoline on a fire. You aren't being a doormat by waiting. You're actually being the only adult in the room.
Mm-hmm.
You're recognizing, through the lens of Dharma, that their anger is a delusion. It's a temporary sickness that's currently tormenting them and forcing them to act terribly. Why would you allow their temporary sickness to force you into generating your own delusion of anger? By not retaliating, you break the karmic cycle of escalation.
That makes a lot of sense. The fourth principle, though, if told one's faults, do not retaliate, that is pure ego death.
It really is.
Someone criticizes you, and the immediate burning instinct is to deflect. Well, you're no saint either, remember when you did, you know? To swallow that instinct, to just listen, to evaluate if the criticism is true without getting defensive, that requires immense internal architecture.
And that practice patience, that immense internal strength, isn't just about cultivating a personal protective bubble of Zen. It is the mandatory preparation for the active, highly demanding work of engaging with other sentient beings.
Which brings us right back to the third morality we discussed at the beginning, the morality of benefiting sentient beings.
Yes, sessions 13 and 14.
This is where the theory is put into practice. He discusses 12 faults related to failing to benefit others, dividing them into two fascinating categories, failing to benefit and failing to subdue.
The faults of failing to benefit are very poignant, everyday failures of compassion, not returning kindness to those who have helped you, not helping those in states of great sadness or physical sickness, not praising the good qualities of those who truly deserve it.
So these are failures to act.
Yes. You're withholding the warmth and support that the bodhisattva path demands.
But the not subduing category is where I think many modern practitioners get entirely tripped up. He says it is a secondary downfall not to discipline those whose actions go against the Dharma. So helping isn't always just smiling, speaking gently, and offering tea. Sometimes it involves active, forceful intervention.
Exactly.
I need you to explain this, because how does a practitioner balance the radical patience we've just discussed, never getting angry back, with the absolute requirement to subdue opposition or discipline someone causing harm?
It all comes back to the precise mechanism of motivation and the total absence of anger. This is precisely why you must master the perfection of patience before you attempt to subdue others.
Right.
If you discipline a student or stop someone from doing harm, and there is even a trace of anger or self-righteousness in your mind, you have broken your practice. You are just acting out your own delusion.
But if the mind is steady...
If your mind is completely steady, rooted entirely in compassion, and you clearly see that someone is generating terrible negative karma for themselves by acting cruelly or against the Dharma, you must intervene to protect them from the consequences of their own actions.
That's a huge shift in perspective.
Think of the parent-toddler dynamic. A parent seeing their toddler run toward a busy street doesn't just smile patiently. They run, they grab the child forcefully, and they might speak very sharply. No. Stop.
Right.
The physical action is forceful, the voice is harsh, but the underlying motivation is pure, frantic protection. There is no hatred for the child. That is subduing with compassion.
That perfectly leads into the 8 ways of assisting others that Geshe Dawa outlines. What struck me as I reviewed these teachings is how incredibly grounded his examples are. When we hear bodhisattva, we imagine a glowing deity floating on a lotus. But Geshe Dawa's instructions are about rolling up your sleeves in the dirt of the real world.
It is deeply, wonderfully practical. Look at the very first of the 8 ways. Considering carefully before acting. Before you launch into some grand, helpful intervention, you must use your wisdom to analyze the situation. Will this action truly benefit them in the long run? Or am I just satisfying my own ego's need to play the savior? Will my intervention actually strip them of their autonomy and cause more harm?
And the other ways are so beautifully mundane, helping persons find their way, literally giving directions to someone who is lost, guarding others' wealth from thieves or exploitation, bringing together those who are separated.
Yes.
He specifically mentions reuniting friends who have argued, healing rifts between couples, and even mediating between conflicting countries. He is talking about active peacemaking and diplomacy in the material world.
Exactly. Assisting the sick physically. Taking responsibility for the work that needs to be done. If there is a community event and there are chairs to be folded and floors to be swept, the Bodhisattva doesn't wait for someone else of quote-unquote lower status to do it. They take responsibility. They do the unseen work.
But let's be honest with ourselves here, looking at this massive architecture. Knowing all these requirements, the 18 root vows, the 46 secondary vows, the absolute requirement to never act out of anger, to always be purely motivated, to always act for others, a practitioner is absolutely bound to fail.
Oh, inevitably.
We are going to break these vows. We are human. We are going to lose our temper in traffic. We are going to indulge in worldly gossip. We are going to act selfishly. When this carefully built scaffolding breaks, what is the remedy? Are we just doomed?
This brings us to the most vital safety net in the Mahayana path, the practice of purification, with bodhicitta acting as the supreme purifier. Geshe Dawa, drawing heavily on Shantideva's magnificent text, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, teaches that bodhicitta is the single strongest force in the universe for outshining negativities.
He explains the mechanics of this purification in a way that is, frankly, staggering. To understand it, we have to look at what the foundational vehicles say about the 5 heinous crimes.
The worst possible karmic action.
Yes, these are killing your mother, killing your father, killing an arhat, which is a fully liberated being, creating a schism in the Sangha or spiritual community, and intentionally drawing blood from a Buddha. In the foundational teachings, these 5 actions are considered almost unpurifiable in this lifetime.
Right. They're said to guarantee an immediate rebirth in the lowest realms of suffering. The karmic weight of those actions is immense.
But Geshe Dawa says otherwise.
He teaches that on the basis of bodhicitta, even the karma of these 5 heinous crimes can be purified. Now, what is fascinating here is the why. Why is the intention of bodhicitta so overwhelmingly powerful? We have to look at the root cause of karma.
Okay, let's break that down.
Negative karma is created by a mind dominated by ignorance and self-cherishing, the obsessive focus on me and my happiness at the expense of others. bodhicitta, the genuine, searing aspiration to achieve Buddhahood, solely to free all other beings from suffering, is the exact diametric opposite of self-cherishing.
It's like turning on a floodlight in a room that has been dark for 1,000 years. The darkness doesn't put up a fight, it just ceases to exist in the presence of light.
That is the traditional analogy, and it is perfectly accurate.
Yeah.
Bodhicitta is a light so bright that it attacks the very foundation of negative karma. Geshe Thawa gives specific daily maintenance protocols to apply this purifier.
What are they?
For breaking bodhisattva vows, the primary remedy is the confession to the Kami Five Buddhas, which involves physical prostrations and reciting specific names and confessions. For breaking tantric vows, it is the Vajrasattva meditation practice. But he is adamant. Both of these practices must be preceded by taking refuge in the three jewels and genuinely generating bodhicitta.
Because without it, it's just mechanical.
Exactly. Without that altruistic motivation, the prostrations are just physical gymnastics and the mantras are just empty chanting.
And here is the daily practice point, the non-negotiable routine for a serious practitioner that Geshe Dawa outlines. One must purify broken vows every single night before going to sleep. You do not let the spiritual rot set in overnight. You do not carry today's broken vows into tomorrow.
Can you do this by applying the four opponent powers?
Let's break down each of the four powers for the listener because they are incredibly practical tools for anyone, regardless of their belief in formal vows. Power number one, the power of regret. I want to clarify, he does not mean guilt.
No, guilt is a toxic, self-centered emotion. Guilt says, I am a terrible person because I did this. It paralyzes you. Regret, in the Buddhist sense, is a clear, objective recognition of cause and effect. It is the intelligence that says, I drank poison today. My action was harmful to others and will cause suffering for me in the future. I deeply regret drinking the poison. It is based on wisdom, not self-loathing.
Power number two, the power of reliance.
Because negative karma is always created in relation to either the holy objects like the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, or sentient beings, we must restore our relationship with them. We do this by taking refuge in the three jewels and by generating bodhicitta toward all sentient beings. We repair the foundation.
Power number three, the power of the antidote.
This is the active countermeasure. It could be doing physical prostrations, reciting purification mantras, reading profound sutras, or even dedicating yourself to a specific act of generosity or community service. You are actively applying a virtuous force against the negative imprint.
And finally, power number four, the power of resolve.
This is the linchpin. You must make a firm, sincere determination not to repeat the action. Even if you can only honestly promise, I will not repeat this action of anger for the next hour or for the next 5 minutes, you must draw a line.
Right.
If you do not resolve to stop, the purification is incomplete. If you apply those four powers completely before sleep, Geshe Dawa assures us there is no negativity that cannot be purified.
Which is such an immense relief, because I have to admit, hearing this vast, intricate list of vows, all the downfalls, the subtle falls, the constant vigilance required, it can induce a sense of profound overwhelm.
Oh, undoubtedly.
It is very easy to look at this architecture and think, I am failing at every single level. I am too angry, too distracted, too selfish. I simply can't do this.
Geshe Dawa anticipates this exact psychological reaction. He understands the immense weight of these teachings on an ordinary mind. And he explicitly, compassionately advises practitioners, do not adopt a defeatist attitude.
That's reassuring.
He says, even if you cannot perform all these bodhisattva deeds right now, even if you utterly failed at the perfection of patience today and lost your temper completely, do not abandon the path. Do not throw away the vows.
So what do we do instead?
Instead, you make strong, pure wishing prayers to be able to fulfill them in the future. You generate the aspiration.
You literally pray, may I one day have the strength and clarity to practice the perfection of patience flawlessly. May I one day be able to give without attachment. You keep the blueprint of the architecture intact, even if you are currently lacking the raw materials to build the roof.
Precisely. The aspiration itself is an immensely powerful form of virtue. It sets the karmic trajectory. So we have the vows, we inevitably break them, and we have the tools to purify them. But there is another side to this coin.
What about the good we do?
Exactly. Once our negativity is purified, how do we protect, sustain, and grow the positive actions, the merit that we do manage to accumulate?
That brings us to session 7 of his teachings and the crucial work of stabilizing the path. Geshe Dawa talks about the precious human rebirth and the four conditions needed to actually practice this Mahayana path, because simply having a human body isn't enough. You need highly specific, conducive circumstances.
He calls them the four wheels of a Mahayana practice, like the wheels of a chariot that allow it to move forward.
What's the first wheel?
First, living in a conducive place. This means an environment where the elements are agreeable, where there's some safety, but also where holy masters have practiced and left an imprint of realization.
Okay, second.
Second, making good wishing prayers at three distinct levels. Praying not to fall into lower realms of suffering, praying for individual freedom from samsara, and ultimately praying for full enlightenment for the sake of all.
And the third condition is relying on qualified beings. This means meeting genuine Mahayana spiritual masters and surrounding yourself with friends who have true Mahayana qualities. There is a very modern psychological truth here. You become the average of the people you spend the most time with.
Very true.
If your community is focused on gossip and accumulation, you will be too. If your friends are striving for patience and bodhicitta, they will elevate you.
And the fourth condition is being fortunate through merit. You must actively collect merit-positive karmic energy right now so that your future practice isn't completely derailed by sudden illness, disastrous life circumstances, or mental collapse.
That fourth point about merit leads to a very sobering observation by Geshe Dawa. He notes that some practitioners can engage in excellent, rigorous intellectual study of the Dharma. They know all the texts. But at the crucial moment of trying to actually realize the teachings in meditation, their mind goes completely blank.
What?
Or they sit down on the cushion to meditate, and suddenly they develop a splitting headache, their back seizes up, or they feel physically ill. But the moment they give up, get off the cushion, and go watch television or engage in worldly activities, they feel perfectly healthy again.
It is a phenomenon almost every serious practitioner has experienced. Geshe Dawa identifies this not as a mere physical ailment, but as a tangible karmic sign of lacking merit.
Lacking the fuel.
Yes, the karmic obstacles to realization are too heavy, and the positive energy, the merit, is too weak to support the deep transformative spiritual work. The mind and body literally rebel against the virtue because they do not have the energetic fuel to sustain it.
So we desperately need to accumulate merit just to be able to practice. But more importantly, once we get a little bit of it, we need to protect it furiously. Because merit is incredibly fragile, isn't it?
Very fragile.
Dishi Dawa analyzes the relationship between anger and merit. And the mechanics of it are terrifying. He states that a single moment of full-blown anger towards a bodhisattva can destroy eons of accumulated, unprotected merit.
It is the ultimate act of spiritual self-sabotage. You spend years, perhaps lifetimes, building a beautiful, intricate, wooden house of virtue. And then in one fleeting moment of uncontrolled rage, you strike a match and burn the entire structure to the ground.
Why does anger do that specifically?
Because anger is a violent rejection of connection, while merit is built entirely on connection and compassion for others. Anger is the antimatter to merit. This is why the perfection of patience isn't just about being a pleasant person to be around. It is the primary, indispensable protector of your spiritual wealth. Patience is the fireproof coating you must apply to your merit.
And once it is protected from anger, how do we make that merit grow? How do we ensure it isn't just used up on a temporary good result, like a healthy week or a slight promotion at work?
The analogy of the juice.
Yes. Geshe Dawa shares this brilliant, unforgettable analogy of the glass of juice to explain the mechanics of dedication.
It perfectly captures one of the most profound spiritual technologies in Buddhism.
He says, imagine you have a small glass of delicious juice. If you just drink it by yourself, it's gone in a few seconds. It served its purpose, it tasted good, and now it is finished.
Right.
But if you take that small glass of juice and you pour it into a massive, vast vat of juice, your little bit of juice is now irrevocably mixed with the whole. It will last until that entire massive vat is completely consumed.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the small glass of juice is the finite merit you created today. Maybe you successfully practiced patience when someone insulted you,
yeah.
Or you helped a stranger, or you completed your morning meditation. If you just keep that merit for yourself, if your underlying thought is, may this good action bring me health, wealth, or a good reputation, that merit is consumed very quickly the moment that worldly result ripens.
You drink the juice and it's gone.
Exactly. But if you dedicate that merit...
How does one do that?
Well, if at the end of the day or immediately after the action, you deliberately say, I dedicate this merit to the supreme, full enlightenment of all sentient beings, mixing it with the inexhaustible merit of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the three times.
Wow.
You've poured your glass into the ocean.
Yeah.
By dedicating it to an infinite goal, the enlightenment of infinite beings, your merit takes on the quality of infinity. It is stabilized. It will not be exhausted until every single sentient being has achieved Buddhahood.
It takes this finite, fragile little spark of daily goodness and makes it eternal. But accumulating this merit in the first place requires joyous effort, and it requires the perfection of giving. As we move into the final sessions of Geshe Dawa's teachings, we see that giving in the Mahayana context is so much broader and more profound than just handing out money or food.
Yes, in the final session, he deeply expands the view of generosity. We often hold a limiting belief that to give the Dharma the highest form of giving, you have to be a highly qualified teacher sitting on a throne delivering formal lectures. Geshe Dawa dismantles that entirely.
How so?
He explains how everyday practitioners, regardless of their status, can give the Dharma constantly.
He gives such beautiful, accessible examples of this expanded generosity. He suggests reciting mantras loudly while you walk in nature or sit in a public park so that insects, animals, and other people can hear the vibration of the holy words. Even if they don't understand it, planting the sonic seed of the Dharma in their mental continuum is a profound act of giving.
He also advises chanting the Heart Sutra aloud. He explains that this attracts gods, nagas, and other unseen beings who are drawn to the sound of the teachings on emptiness. You are literally hosting a dharma, teaching for beings you cannot even perceive.
That's incredible.
Or, when you recite the 21 praises to Tara, you use your imagination to visualize that all sentient beings of the universe are surrounding you, reciting it along with you. You're bringing them into the field of virtue.
That brings us to one of the most profound practices he mentions, which is the ultimate fusion of generosity, patience, and bodhicitta, Tonglen, the practice of giving and taking.
Tonglen is the absolute distillation of the Mahayana path into a single meditation technique. It works directly with the breath.
How does the visualization work?
With every exhalation, you visualize giving away all your happiness, your merit, your perfect health, your wealth, and your spiritual realizations to all sentient beings. You visualize transforming your body, your very existence, into whatever they need. Cooling water for the thirsty, medicine for the sick, shelter for the unhoused, comfort for the grieving.
And the taking part.
With every inhalation, you visualize taking on all their suffering, their negative karma, their pain, their illnesses, and their delusions. You breathe it in as thick black smoke, and you bring it down into your own heart to smash and destroy the dark, hard lump of self-cherishing that resides there. You use their suffering as the weapon to destroy your own ego.
Geshe Dawa emphasizes that even though Tonglen is primarily a mental visualization, it is categorized as a profound form of material giving. Why? Because it conditions the mind so thoroughly in the perfection of generosity that when a real-world opportunity to give arises, the mind doesn't hesitate. It removes the subtle sting of miserliness.
It rewires the brain from self-protection to radical generosity. But all of this, the 18 root vows, the 46 secondary faults, the purification powers, the dedication of merit, the profound practice of Tonglen, it all hinges entirely on one crucial factor: actual lived application.
So what does this all mean? We can sit here and map out the brilliant architecture of the Bodhisattva path for hours, but Geshe Dawa brings it all crashing down into everyday reality with his final devastating analogy, the analogy of counting someone else's money.
It is a piercing critique of purely intellectual Dharma study. He says you can work as a bank teller, counting millions of dollars every single day. You know exactly what a $100 bill looks like. You know how to stack them perfectly. You know all the serial numbers, and you are surrounded by wealth.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you go home to a tiny apartment and eat instant noodles. Why? Because the money isn't yours. You were just counting someone else's wealth.
Knowing all these vows intellectually, being able to recite a Sangha's texts from memory, debating the fine philosophical points of the Akashagarbha Sutra with your friends, it is utterly useless if you do not apply it directly to your own mind. If you know the vows but still yell at your spouse, you are just counting the Buddha's money. You have to take this spiritual wealth and use it to buy your own freedom from delusion.
Which is precisely why he advises that while a practitioner should read widely and take what is useful from many different texts, always being careful never to disrespect different presentations of the teachings, you must ultimately keep one text, one set of instructions, as your core main practice. You must dig one deep well until you strike water, rather than digging 100 shallow holes and remaining thirsty.
And he adds a final, deeply urgent piece of advice. Accumulate this merit, do this practice, take these vows while you were young and healthy, because the young do not stay young, and the healthy do not stay healthy. The window of opportunity provided by this precious human rebirth is closing with every single breath we take.
It is a sobering but deeply motivating truth. The Bodhisattva vows are not some abstract philosophy meant for a future idealized version of yourself. They are the essential daily mechanism for right now. They are the only way to transform your ordinary, flawed, messy daily actions into the direct causes of full enlightenment.
And that really brings us full circle, doesn't it? Back to where we started with our premise. We thought of vows as a cage, as a restrictive way to isolate ourselves and keep our own personal karma perfectly clean and untouched by the world.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at Geshe Dawa Gyaltsen's teachings, looking at the sheer scale of the Bodhisattva's commitment to others, a completely different reality emerges.
The architecture of the vows is built entirely on our relationship to others. There is no solitary Bodhisattva.
Exactly. The structure only exists in the context of connection. And it leaves me with this thought to consider for you listening today. If mixing our tiny, fragile glass of merit with the vast ocean of the merit of all sentient beings is the only way to ensure it lasts forever,
then perhaps our ultimate spiritual survival doesn't depend on how isolated, safe, and pure we can keep our own individual practice.
Perhaps it depends entirely on how thoroughly, how radically, and how bravely we are willing to intertwine our spiritual fate with the messy, difficult, everyday lives of the people around us.
The scaffolding holds us up, yes, but it only holds us up so we can reach down and pull others up with us.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into Geshe Dawa Gyaltsen's foundation of practice. We encourage you to take these profound teachings off the cushion today. Approach your next conversation, your next frustration, your next mundane task at work or at home, not as a distraction from your spiritual life, but as the very foundation of your practice.